Hello, welcome to Holden Village. Today is Monday, July 6th, 1998. In the fireside room this afternoon is Walter Wangren Jr. He's starting a series titled The Writer of the Broadaxe. It's session number 98-5, and this one's title is The Writer Whose Head is a Fire. Let's listen in.
People are going to be coming in a little bit as we go, and then going out as we go. It's fine. It's casual. My name is Walt Wangren. I have responded to several vocations in my life. I am now, just a minute, honestly, it is not, let's see, I was born in 44, what am I? I'm 54 years old.
That's called senior pause.
It's called what?
Senior pause when you can't remember.
Senior pause?
You'll learn to use that more and more while
thank you. I'm 54 and have, as I said, responded to a variety of vocations. I've been a teacher as well as a pastor. I have been a parent, still am that. Husband. I've worked with migrant workers, spent time with the Lakota Indians several times over. The reason I'm telling you that, though, is the subject for this week from me comes from that vocation which in me is as deep as the deepest waters. I have known from the time that I was in grade school that I would write. In fact, I wrote from the time I was in grade school. I didn't always understand fully what that meant. I think that before I understood the word vocatus or vocation in its deepest sense, not necessarily something by which you make money, but that calling, which is the grundwerk or the groundwork of all one's callings, I think I've understood something of that even already in high school. When I was young, when I was in grade school, I was already writing short stories. When I was in the eighth grade, I remember that I got serious about writing a novel. In my mind, that was no different from my brothers who played sports and my sisters. They were good at sport. Well, they watched sports first, and it was a very natural step for them to play sports. In our society, no one is surprised by that step. I read books, and it seemed a natural step to me to move from reading the books to writing the books, although I think many people were just a bit curious about that. I tried to read my novel to my mother when I was in the eighth grade, and she had this peculiar capacity of having to go to the bathroom every time I wanted to read a new chapter. So I read it through the bathroom door, and she stayed in there a long time. I'm leading up to what the theme is, but what I hope is that I sort of gather some of you on the way for this theme. When I was in high school, I had a creative writing course with a man whose name was Barber, James Barber. If we had time, I would tell you much about this man. In some respects, for all of us, he was kind of a hero figure. Now, this is way back, so you know, forgive all whatever you think is wrong about this, but he used to smoke in class, and we thought that was amazingly free. This is high school, and the man would smoke cigarettes in class. He had a carbuncle on his butt, which really has nothing to do with anything. Except that's the way in which he used to sit. He'd sit up in the front talking to us. He had this high, sort of whining voice, and he'd always sit like this. Well, and no, it does have something, now that I think about it, to do with what I'm telling you, is that when we asked him about that, he said, I have a carbuncle in my butt. He was very free. He taught creative writing, and he is much responsible for the affirmation that a child needs at certain points as that child grows toward a vocation. We wrote short stories, and I remember that once he was passing back the short stories that had been written. I'm W, so I'm sitting in the back. And mine was about the last one. He plopped it on my desk, and as he was walking forward, James Barber said in that high nasal voice, he said, Wangren can write the eyes of a turkey at 50 paces. And I sat there dazzled. I just was dazzled. I didn't know what he meant. But I understood that he was talking praise to my writing, and he was doing it in his language, not mine. He's not talking down to me. I learned pretty soon thereafter that he was talking about accuracy. that I was very accurate in my descriptions. I immediately sent that story out to have it sold. It came back. In graduate school, in college, I quietly and privately said to myself I would become the best poet of my age. And in graduate school, I set myself to writing a poem a day, which I did for 2 years. And first of all, it grieved me because it wasn't necessarily good in the morning. And then I thought, no, this is practice. I finally broke silence and wrote home to my parents saying that I thought I would be a writer. And my mother writes back, practical advice. And my father just gets nervous and he keeps telling me I need that graduate credit card, or no, what do you call that? Union card. He called it the union card. Get jobs and stuff, money. My mom writes back and she says, good, Wally, good, writer. She said, write greeting cards. She said, there's money in greeting cards. But I've continued at it. And in 1988, I did a series about what I thought on the surface a writer was committed to. And in a sense, this is a follow-up to that. You don't need to have heard that to understand this. But for those of you who live around a long time, you might listen to at least the first two tapes from that 1989 series, and this will build from it. I want to talk to you about art. I want to talk to you specifically about writing, since that's my art. I want to introduce you or invite you into some of the more private areas of this activity. I want to invite you to come with me because some of you are, in various respects, artists. Don't have to be an artist of the word. You can be an artist of flower arrangement, of painting, of the dance, of music, of acting. I mean, there are a great variety of arts. You can be a quilt maker. I mean, you imagine now yourself. I'm going to give you in a moment a definition of what I think art is so that you might fetch up underneath that. Some of you love people whose sensibilities are artistic and you just don't understand them. Or they think you don't understand them, which amounts to the same thing. They hard to talk. I'm not necessarily going to get at the psychology of the artist. That's an infinitely complex and evasive thing. But I am going to get at some of these passions, these focused and fierce intensities, four of them, in fact. And others of you, I hope, have friends who are artists, and maybe this will crack open to you some of your own understandings of things. I'm going to use as a framing device for the four presentations that I have this excellent book by Annie Dillard. It's called Holy the Firm. Maybe some of you don't know it, even though you know her. It's a slim book. It's dense with metaphoric conversation. She writes, her prose is as poetic as anyone I know. And she talks here intensely about this business, actually of writing, but it'll embrace the arts. And I'm going to use some of her ideas. I'll begin with her ideas with every one of these sessions. I'll read you something, and then I'll spin from that. Anyway, this will be the framing device. Each time I do, I'll tell you at least one story, and then I will use some of my own material. Now, who gave the announcements at lunch today?
Mark.
Okay, what Mark said is probably not necessarily true anymore. I mean, I can give these things up front, and then I'm thinking and thinking all the time and saying, no, not that, yes, this, and then so forth and so on. So I probably won't make much reference to Dun Cow, but I will read you a piece from Ms. Lill. So I will make reference to the work, to her, and then I will try to teach you on the way these four intensities. If you don't mind, I recognize that when I read you, and I'll do my best to read with panache and skill and excitement, but I recognize that when one reads rather than tells stories, it requires more of the listening audience. When I tell stories, you will see I will give you my whole body. I will gesture and smile and jump around and raise my voice and lower my voice. When I read, however, I can't do that. I have to honor the words of somebody else. And so my voice will be as supple as possible, but it requires you, you know, to allow these things, imagination in your mind. In the book Holy the Firm, which is divided into three parts, day one, day two, day three, I forget what they are, Thursday, Friday, Saturday possibly, Annie imagines what happens between these 3 days to draw her to a deeper, almost explosive understanding of what it is the artist or the writer does. And so there'll be a dramatic progression here. On the very first day, she's living in the Northwest, which seems very appropriate to me right now. During the writing of this, she's living on the islands off the Washington coast, so that it seems to her that she's as far west as one gets. And she wonders what west is after that west, except possibly death or the truth. She remembers something that happened to her two summers ago. She's living in a single room place, and she's living very spare. She's also teaching when she writes this to students, and you'll get a sense of that as I read this to you now. She's living exceedingly spare in this room, where she can look out and she can see the ridges of the mountains, the names of which she's trying to learn, except it just blows her mind that she's looking east to the mountains, not west. And west to the Thule, to the islands. She has one cat that lives with her, and she has dead moths under her toilet. And that starts a thought in her mind. And I'll tell you immediately, this is, I think, a remarkable image. You won't forget it. You might consider, she doesn't say this right up front, but I'm going to tell it to you since you're not reading the whole book. I don't tell my students this if ever I teach this book, that she's beginning to build. This isn't the end of it. She's beginning to build an image of the artist. Two summers ago, I was camping alone in the Blue Ridge Mountains in Virginia. I had hauled myself and gear up there to read, among other things, James Ramsey Ullman's The Day on Fire. It's a novel about Rimbaud, and if any of you know Rimbaud, the French poet, this is simply a remarkable figure who writes with great loathing about the world around him, but he's a young fellow, and this writing is just simply exquisite and explosive. That's, I think, significant as she happens to choose this. Rimbaud, that had made me want to be a writer when I was 16, says Annie. Oh, by the way, she wrote Pilgrim at Tinker Creek, if any of you are familiar with that, and it's very likely she was writing that book when this event took place. I was hoping it would do it again, so I read, lost, every day, sitting under a tree by my tent, while warblers swung in the leaves overhead and bristleworms trailed their inches over the twiggy dirt at my feet. And I read every night by candlelight while barred owls called in the forest and pale moths masked round my head in the clearing where my light made a ring. Moths kept flying into the candle. They would hiss and recoil, lost upside down in the shadows among my cooking pans. Or they would singe their wings and fall, and their hot wings, as if melted, would stick to the first thing they touch, a pan, a lid, a spoon, so that the snagged moths could flutter only in tiny arcs. By the way, watch her careful attention to detail. This is going to be an issue. It's people like this that remember the things that you saw and forgot. These I could release by a quick flip of the stick. In the morning I would find my cooking stuff gilded with torn flecks of moth wings, triangles of shiny dust here and there on the aluminum. So I read and boiled water and replenished candles and read on. One night, a moth flew into the candle, was caught, burnt dry, and held. I must have been staring at the candle, or maybe I looked up when a shadow crossed my page. At any rate, I saw it all. A golden female moth, a biggish one with 2-inch wingspan, flapped into the fire, dropped her abdomen into the wet wax, stuck, flamed, frazzled, and fried in a second. Her moving wings ignited like tissue paper, enlarging a circle of light in the clearing and creating out of the darkness the sudden blue, it's amazing, sudden blue sleeves of my sweater, the green leaves of jewelweed by my side, the ragged red trunk of pine. Now I'm bursting in, and you, I know, are smart enough to realize what's going on here. But if we begin to realize that this is something of the act of the writer, this is what the writer does, suddenly flame near you and allow you to see things that had somehow or other passed into your darkness. And it may not be just the jewelry. It may be the laughter. The laughter you've been hearing all along, but in the light of this particular kind of artist, that laughter suddenly shows itself to be infinitely melancholy and sad. Do you understand what I'm saying? Amen. At once the light contracted again and the moth's wings vanished in a fine, foul smoke. At the same time, her six legs clawed, curled, blackened, and ceased, disappearing utterly. And her head jerked in spasms, making a spattering noise. Her antenna crisped and burned away, and her heaving mouth parts crackled like pistol fire. Be with me. Watch it. Hear it. When it was all over, her head was, so far as I could determine, gone. Gone the long way of her wings and legs. Had she been new or old? Had she mated or laid eggs? Had she done her work? All that was left was the glowing horn shell of the abdomen and thorax, a fraying, partially collapsed gold tube jammed upright in the candle's round pool. And then this moth essence, this spectacular skeleton, began to act as a wick. She kept burning. The wax rose in the moth's body from her soaking abdomen to her thorax, to the jagged hole where her head should be, and widening into flame, a saffron-yellow flame that robed her to the ground like any immolating monk. That candle had two wicks, two flames of identical height, side by side. The moth's head was a fire. She burned for 2 hours until I blew her out. She burned for 2 hours without changing, without bending or leaning, only glowing within, like a building fire glimpsed through the silhouetted walls, like a hollow saint, like a flame-faced virgin gone to God, while I read by her light, kindled, while Rimbaud and Paris burnt out his brains in 1,000 poems, while night pooled wetly at my feet. I think I know moths, and fragments of moths, and chips and tatters of utterly empty moths in any state. And now comes the question, y'all, which I also put to my class. I teach the highest level creating and writing, the last one at Valkyries. How many of you, I ask the people in my class, which of you want to give your lives to be writers? I was trembling from coffee or cigarettes or the closeness of faces all around me. Is this what we live for, she thought. Is this the only final beauty, the color of any skin and any light and living human eyes? All the hands rose to the question. You, Nick? Will you? Margaret? Randy? Why do I want them to mean it? And then I tried to tell them what the choice must mean. You can't be anything else. You must go at your life with a broad axe. They had no idea what I was saying. I have two eyes, don't I? And all this energy for as long as I can remember. I'll do it in the evenings after skiing. Or on the way home from the bank. Or after the children are asleep. They thought I was raving again, she says. It's just as well. I like that image. I like that image. You burn your head out. And then what you become in your whole life and the whole business of your life is that which shines light in other things. Let me add one more quote, which I think is a remarkable conclusion to this particular passage. How can people think that artists seek a name? You know, the curious thing is that when I write, even when I write about myself and it goes forth and people read it and they say, oh, I know you, Walt. And they do, they know exactly what I wrote, but I control it. Or they say, oh, I know you, Than. And they do, they understand what they read and I wrote. Nevertheless, the curious thing about writing is that what you write on the page is no longer the who that wrote it. It is no longer the who that wrote it. You don't have to understand this, but just at least hear me say it once. This one walks like a Walt and talks like a Walt and quacks like a Walt, but it's not a Walt. It looks exactly like it. But there's always that sort of, there's that artistic thing itself, which in the very writing is the loss of self. It is the very loss of self, what you send out in the writing, what you send out to the people who read or who look at the material that you have, is in effect its own complete life thereafter. Almost like you blew bubbles and they go out and your air is in there, your breath is in there, almost that deific breath creates the roundness of the thing. But you've gone to the bathroom. How can people think that artists seek a name? A name, like a face, is something you have when you're not alone. There is no such thing as an artist. There is only the world, lit or unlit, as the light allows. When the candle is burning, who looks at the wick? When the candle is out, who needs it? But she says the world without light is wasteland and chaos, and a life without sacrifice, she says, is an abomination. I love Annie Dillard. I love Annie Dillard. All right, let me sketch some things. What I'm going to talk specifically about, and I'll lead up to it, is this passion for craft. Today, the passion for craft, the stuff of writing itself, that it be done right. Tomorrow, the passion for the other, this, as I call it, the fierce and focused intensity upon the other, meaning other people, not necessarily readers, but other people. The next day, which will be Thursday, it'll be that fierce, focused passion for the details, the stuff of living. And then Friday it'll become, and I think, you know, all the writers that I know, and this doesn't take, by the way, any particular religion. In fact, for many writers, the writing becomes this holy act. But it becomes a sort of passion focused for divinity, somehow. Some ground between the ground, as Annie Dillard says. All right. So let me start here. By the way, I'm going to thank you up front, because this is my pleasure. I'm talking about stuff that I think about, and I have very little chance to talk about it, and so you are all granting me grace. Now, I can talk about these things and put them in your ears, and you're going to listen. Let's begin with a working definition. I would not argue this, and some of you who are artists may do it differently, but let me present you a working definition of art. I simply want to present it so you know what I'm working with, and it's become for me very pragmatic in understanding what I do. Not all my books are art. I know which ones I think are art. When I tell my publisher I'm sending them a book that they think that I think is art, they all groan. Seriously, we didn't talk about that one day. They really want that stuff that's going to sell. Yeah. And I'm back here doing my, flaming my head. They're saying, I would like to put it down simply as a premise that art is always an event. Not a thing, but an action. It's always an event. That when we call, what we call art, like the painting itself, is the potential of art, really. This is not to take away all the other meanings of art, but just so that we understand. I think that when art is what art ought to be, something's happening. There's always a happening. So although we can call the painting art, it isn't meant to be packed away. And down in the basement, everyone says, yeah, art's down there. There is art. It's in that package down in the basement. No. What I think happens, let me give you an example. I remember the first time I saw Chartres Cathedral. That was an event, but it was only half of the event of the art. I remember that we were hitchhiking. I was 19 years old, and I just spent about 5 months hitchhiking around Europe, which you could do in those days with less fear. And I remember we were coming across the flat plains toward Chartres, and there were those double spires. You could see them far away. Almost, I don't know, I didn't see them as an invitation, but I saw them as a weight upon the earth and a stretching, a declaration, a presence, which I was not at yet and for which I didn't have a relationship yet. But I remember when we got into town. Now, the weird thing is that there's buildings all around, so you can't stand back in town and look at this thing. You have to go into it. When you first see it, it's like a fountain of light stone in front of you that goes higher and higher. It's amazing how stone can seem so light, this kind of Gothic architecture, which I won't talk about, just my own feeling. You don't have a choice. You enter. And when you stand at the back of the nave, and the chancel is way down in the front, you know, that standing altar, and you see these light, narrow blue windows, and the blue light coming from behind, but you're scarcely aware of it. You can't stand still. Everything wants you to move forward. It calls you forward. Now, I know in studying architecture, it has to do with how the pillars and the columns are made, that they are in a kind of a regular rhythm, just the way poetry and music has rhythm, and the rhythm of the thing itself calls you two ways. It calls you forward. You stand there. I defy you to stand there unless you're in a tourist group and they're announcing, blah, 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 blah. This is rubbernecking. I understand rubbernecking. Rubbernecks. You go there by yourself, you open up your heart, and the building calls you forward. You've got to walk forward and up. Everything wants to go up. That tracery in the ceiling, that light tracery, the windows that are as narrow as tears crying down, make you want to go forward and up. And the light itself in the front, the dome that's over the altar portion, all of it, that's art working. But it's only half of art. Art will always be event. And sometimes the first half and the second half happen exactly together. And sometimes they are as far apart as millennia. I will divide it into two. What I just described to you, please, for me and the full understanding of art, it cannot be that you learn something for the day. You know, I went to Sunday school and I had really good Sunday school teachers because they could tell stories. When they told stories, art was happening. As soon as they were done, if art was a balloon, they took a needle and they popped it. Bam! It wasn't there anymore. You know how they did that? They said, what did we learn from this? Bam! Because what is art? When it is active, it is for us who watch it, who listen to it, it's experience. It is experience. So the painting, when I stand in front of it, becomes a dialogue between me and not even necessarily the painter, but the painting with its textures and its shapes and its varieties of colors. And of course, for some people, I'm going to talk so fast. Well, you know, for some art, you really need to be trained. I can't go to Germany and talk their language right away. I've got to learn the language. And I, you know how sometimes people walk in and look at art and they'll say, yep, doesn't do anything for me. And on they go. Well, there's been no dialogue there, and I don't blame them. It may not do anything for them because they haven't learned what language is there and what's happening. You understand what I'm saying? But there will always be that dialogue. Sometimes it's immediate. I tell you a story, you're here, we're doing it together, and I love the intimacy and the intense presentness of my acting and your receiving, of my acting and your experiencing. What am I doing that you might experience? What am I as the writer or the artist doing? I am, and I like this word, it's there often, and used to, I avoided it. I am composing. That is to say, I'm taking the stuff of this existence, and I'm putting it into some kind of order, some kind of harmony, some weighty rhythm, which may or may not make sense. It doesn't have to mean something to your brains. You know, again and again, when we make it mean something to our brains, as I say, we pop the experience out of it. What? Here, if this board is experience, you want to get into it. I want to be here. You tell me a story, I want to be in it. But as soon as you say, what does it mean? Pop, I'm out of it, and you're asking me now to level only my intelligence to this thing and think it through in a Western analytic way. The way in which my son wants to understand a watch is he takes it apart. The way in which often the Western mind wants to understand a piece of art is it takes it apart. Oh yeah, here's a little, see that image? Does that image work for you? Well, do that finally, yes, please, but first just listen to my story. First, just experience it. Are you all with me in this? Yeah. And so what I finally use as a definition for art is composed experience. It isn't just any experience. It is one that has had a thinking and composing mind behind it. The beauty of the mountains is not art for me, although they may overwhelm me with experience, because I must always see one of us, this is our human community, one of us having composed what is there. The beauty of the mountains may trigger art, and someone paints it, and so there is a composition, and you know, all of you know, that when you're painting that mountain, you're seeing it as perhaps no one else has ever seen it, even though you're trying to get it exactly right, because your perspective, your thought, your history, your taste, your sense, your shaky little hand while you're painting, and all of those things are going to grab one kind of perspective on it. You will compose that mountain as it never was before. Then you're the artist. Then you show it to me, and I don't have to look at it. I don't have to, oh, yeah, you got it just right. No, even photographs that seem to be exactly the stuff of living are nevertheless composed. Are you with me?
Yes.
Amen.
Yes.
Amen. Right. Well, and so, what is this experience if it is composed? By the way, you now understand where it's posed and where it's separate. The dancer is composing. The dancer is taking somebody else's, perhaps the one who choreographed it, their composition, and giving it flesh. So there's already that, this is how complex it gets. There's that communication. The choreographer might have done that a long time ago. And so the dancer dances that. As she dances, however, she becomes the artist composing the experience of her body and the space of the room and the distance and the closeness to other people. And then the people are experiencing it. There's an immediacy. I write in my room. I compose in my room, and with all my flaming head, I try to imagine you. Oh, you're not there. And I won't be there when you read. And so there is that separation. Composed experience. Let me say several things about this experience, and then you'll understand why I feel so strong about how the artist does this. And craft. This is an experience among experiences. You go to a play, you come out of that play, and you take that experience and you put it on the shelf with the meal you had that night, right? And your life is made up of experiences as you go, sliding and slipping and together and apart. So it's one among many, and therefore it may have no more influence than that it was a pleasant evening at the theater. On the other hand, this experience also, in a sort of sacred way, has its own beginning and middle and ending. It is what we call discrete. That means it gathers all of the real life stuff you have, but it puts it into an experience. It puts your details into an experience with its own discrete and separate existence. It's separate from. It is of, this is where you all have to work with me. I know I'm just teaching you. It is of human experience, but it is separate from human experience when you actually walk in and experience it. A Shakespeare play or a good movie, the movie Unforgiven, I don't know what you want to pick, but where it works very well For the moment, dear people, and this is more than a metaphor, this is the truth, for a moment while you are experiencing that piece of art, it has become the world. It doesn't just reflect a world, but for the moment it is the cosmos in which you dwell. And now all the details, number one, that's what I mean by discrete. In a sense, you suspend disbelief. In a sense, you walk into this event, this experience, and that's the truth for a while for you. That's the world in which you are. Now, the better and the better the art, the less and less you think about what's happening, the more you trust what's taking place for you. The worse the art, the more you have to start thinking, yeah, that was a mistake. And as soon as you begin this analytic mind, you pop out of it. As soon as you're saying, yeah, well, I don't like the way she did that, well, then either she's not good enough or you've given up this gentle covenant that you made with the artist of just obeying for a while and listening. Follow? So now we're saying that this experience is unique in that it becomes a cosmos. It is discrete. It also has an internal integrity. That means all the parts fit for power. Here come the soldiers. They're going to march over that bridge. If they all march together, what's going to happen to that bridge? It's going to vibrate with their steps, and the weight and the stress will be enormous, and a simple band of marching people can break that bridge down. That's why they have to break stride when they cross the bridge. This is what art is. All of its details, all of its theme, all the details of the story march together with a rhythm that grants it then, not just an experienced cosmos, but a cosmos with an immediate sense of power over you. When a movie works well, there is not one extraneous detail. Many movies don't work well. But all the details weave and work together. Now, dear people, comes the main issue. Therefore, from time immemorial, and this I would argue, if anyone wants to, from time immemorial, the ways in which we have been told how to understand the world have been not through teachings and doctrines, but have been through story and art. When a people would tell its people their epic story, which if we lack it, we are lonely people indeed. They were literally walking into that epic. When people would tell the myth, they would walk into that story, and that story would become for them the cosmos through whose windows they would understand, oh, that's what sky is about. God put the sky there as a kind of protective firmament. Mm-hmm, yeah. And now I have a relationship to the sky. But you don't teach that. The child feels that. You tell stories to the children that they need, and every time you tell it, what you're doing is inviting them into a protected place for a while where all that is in the world happens also here, but happens in safety. As they dwell in your story, then they will go out of this, as I said, this experience. They'll step out of it, but the experience will have taught them how to see, how to name, how to define, how to realize their place in the world. Now, did I just make sense, or do I need to say that again?
Understand.
You do? To someone not?
Yeah.
Because I'll go after it again. This is very important. What I'm talking now about is composed experience that it has a greater power on you than a baseball game. I'm sorry. Those of you who love baseball. I mean, baseball can become a metaphor for the world, but the art which, and you must understand, art sometimes is so subtle you don't even know you're doing it. The Eskimos in the long winter nights would lie down with all their heads to the fire. There'd be a period of time when they would whisper and murmur to each other, lovers over here, whispering and everyone else leaving them alone, and the children over here. But at some point, the mother would begin to sing. And in her singing, in her rhythmic singing, she would start to tell the tales of the people. As she told the tales of the people, you know, that igloo, whatever it was they were in, which sometimes is stone, sometimes is wood, sometimes is dirt, sometimes is ice, would light up with not just their past history, but their present world. And every time they would tell a story with a hero, every one of the people in there was that hero. Was that hero. Yes? Amen. Why I'm stressing this is, if art has that power, then by God, the artist better be careful. And for me, whatever I would say to any other artist who cares to listen, I don't know, I would answer. But for me, it means I must be very careful to get it right. Because what if I tell a lie? What if, for example, in my art, unconsciously, without even knowing what I'm doing, I, let's say, make those people who don't have white skin somehow in our universe inferior? And you listen to my art. And you believe it because it's powerful. Unconsciously, you will have been shaped in that peculiar and particular kind of relationship. How to deal with the others. How many stories do parents tell children in their family, which stories are verily art? Stories of experiences where they begin by saying, well, this only just happened to me and another lot, but boy, that one time when I was walking, those black guys came across the street and they just beat me up. And what is that story supposed to mean when you tell it? What really in your heart is the effect of that little arc, that little story into which you're inviting the children to dwell for a while? And what's happening to the children? Yes, art is powerful. It happens all the time. And which of you who are Christians really did ever just sit down and tell the Christian story to your children? Just tell it. So they could fetch up in it and live it. And live it in the thrumming rhythms of your own sweet and maternal voice. Or did you just leave that to the pastors who didn't do it anyway because they were preaching? Well, I'm just throwing out little clues and thoughts here for you. See, there's art always around us. How do you... Let me just give you a few more ideas so that you can chew on, and then I want to give you a good example of a person who I... remarkable artist. How many of you are aware that the architecture of your house and the way in which you furnish it becomes a small cosmos of the larger cosmos you hope your children are growing into? How many of you notice that the architecture of church, for example, various kinds of churches, defines for you some of the things that that particular religion presumed to be the cosmos in the world? There always was that sense that the place in which you worship reflected, or in a holy and sacred way, contained the cosmos itself. So you walk into a Presbyterian church or two, not all of them, and you look at the cool blue lines and you say, yep, this is a rational people. It's like I walked into somebody's mathematic mind. Not all Presbyterian churches, but some of them. I mean, they're so cool and neat, and I really like that, just plain glass. And you walk into the Lutherans, you know, and they're just a little uncertain. If they were Roman Catholic, you know, stories are exploding all over the place. And the drama of this universe filled with the saints, you know, and all kinds of spiritual things going on. Well, the Lutherans are just a little bit uncertain about that. We'll put a little uncertain about statuary. So we're not sure how people, and this really has happened. I mean, as time has gone on, we Lutherans have more and more cleansed our churches out. We made them simpler and simpler. What does that mean? What are we telling those who worship there within that architecture, which represents consciously or not? Just think of it. I'm not making judgments because I'm talking about things that are so various that I cannot comprehend them all. But think about that. So, do you think if you're in a house that really is precious and careful about absolute cleanliness, that you're saying something to those who come in or who raise in that house? Or what about the houses that are rather more sloppy? What is that? Indians don't like to live in square, or the Plains Indians, don't like to live in square buildings. They really resisted it. And honestly, the whites who were giving them houses could not understand that. They want to live in round buildings. Why? Because round mimics the world and the whole cosmos as they know it. For them, life is what they call Kangleshka Wakan, the holy circle, the holy hoop. And we can talk on and on about that, but to be in a square thing is so unnatural to them because in fact what it is in their minds, what it is an imposition upon the truth of the world. It's the hand of the builder saying, no, I'll make the universe in my image. All I'm doing is expanding. Now let's get to the craft. I want to tell you about a woman in my parish named Aloise Story who was everything. She was a pianist, but not good. She was a singer and very good. She was a nurse. She was a teacher. She was a remarkable woman. Her husband, Nat Story, had played a trombone. Everyone talked about Nat Story. He played a jazz trombone in Evansville. But he was dead when I came. And she, Mrs. Story, she was one of these black women who was determined to make a good pastor out of me. And she had every right to, because I came nervous and scared. And she was one who watched over. She took Than and me down to New Orleans because she thought we ought to know the Lutheran black convocation. Well, it was a black congregation, of course, and we were the only white ones there. Two of our children were adopted in black, but two were white. And I remember when we were down there, this is to let you know about her. We went out to a cafeteria where we got our own food and sat down. And then these people come by, you know, who want to get you your drinks. And I remember sitting at that table, Mrs. Story, who stood about this tall and simply was a woman of great emotional strength, intellectual strength. She was talking to a waiter who came and stood over her like this. And I saw her craning back from that waiter in a way that was obvious to me, but perhaps not to the waiter. And then all of a sudden, this woman, who was in her 60s, this woman rose out of her chair as if she were some kind of firework. She rose out of the chair and put her finger in the face of the waiter. And I don't remember what said to him, but said it with such force that he literally was driven backward. And I put my head down, and in my heart I said, overreacting. I didn't see anything. Overreacting. But she wasn't. This woman knew racism, and at that time I did not know all the signs of it. It took me a long time, loving my children and loving the people in my parish, to begin to realize that those who evince those signs also don't know of it. So I'm looking at their faces. She's looking at all these other little signs. This is a strong woman. Where she got her nursing degree was in a white place where she was simply strong. And this is back in the 40s. She had to withstand it. Where she taught was in a place where she was the only black woman teaching, and she was strong. She lived in a two-story white house in the middle of the inner city on the corner of Judson and Little Canal. It's not there anymore. When I go back to Evansville, I stand on that blank, empty land, and I do obey since to Eloise's story, truly. That white house was the one clean thing in a crushed and crashed neighborhood. She kept it shining white. She had a fence around it, but it was like her declaration of order and good sense in the midst of this really messy, messy place. Homeless were around there, just up Little Canal. Half a block was Doc's Liquor Store. And of course, you can't drink in Doc's Liquor, but you can buy it, and then they drink outside. And right across, when I would visit her, they would be standing in a little field she did not own across from her house, and that's where they would urinate. And that's where they fall out. And there was this woman, sitting in the midst of this kind of wretchedness, with a pure white house. On the inside, she had two pianos and an organ. And she kept all of her furniture covered in plastic, so that there was a persistent cleanliness. And this was not a house that was vinyl siding. This is clapboard white. She made sure it was painted shining white every year, like her declaration that within this place, someone had created a sweet and ordered cosmos. Well, as I would visit her over the years, I began to see that she was pounding her hand on her knee. She'd be sitting, and she'd be going like this when I'd come talk to her. And finally, she wouldn't talk about it. She seldom talked about herself, but I was the pastor, and so she would honor my questions. I got much better after those first years. And she said it's because there was no feeling, and she just couldn't control this hand anymore. And we prayed about it, but she was in an anguish because no one in Evansville could tell her what was happening. It was creeping up from her hands. She realized when she couldn't get her garage door up above this that it was affecting all of her arms. And Nat Story was dead, and she was maintaining that pure white house on her own. And she went to doctor after doctor in Evansville. They wouldn't do anything. They couldn't find anything for her. And it was getting worse. So she, on her own, said, she's going to Mayo's Clinic. No one would go with her. This woman of infinite strength. I drove her to the airport, and we talked about what was going to happen. She showed me what she had. She had one suitcase, and she had her umbrella. And she could barely walk, and so she was also taking a wheelchair. Imagine this woman, would you please? Leaving southern Indiana to go up to Minnesota to Mayo's Clinic on her own, spending the money that she had saved, she and Nat, to find out what's the matter with her, that she's losing strength and control in her arms. The reason she had her umbrella, she said, is that when she goes through the airport in her wheelchair, stick it straight out in front of her, nobody's going to be in her way. And that was true. That was it. Boom, boom, boom. Eloise Story went and stayed almost a month and came home despairing because she just came home. They couldn't tell her what was happening. This loss of her nerves and the loss of control. I try to remember now whether it was also a loss of feeling, but I don't know. And it was getting worse. And then she got a letter from the city. And the letter simply said that her house now was in public domain. They're going to clean up this part of the city, and so they will give her fair market value, but they want to bring this beautiful white house down so that they can plant in that place a little mall. A little mall. And of course, all the government is saying to us, well, this is to help the inner city out. And in one sense, we do need businesses in the inner city. But in another sense, this wasn't the inner city people putting money in it. It's the people on the outside who never drive through the inner city. They never drive through for fear. So they have no idea what beauty lives in the inner city. And so here the government is sending letters to people like Mrs. Story saying, we're going to take your house for fair market value. And she called me at that time, never cried. I never saw this woman cry. But she hits her hand and she says, what can we do? Now, I write in those days a column for the Scripps Howard newspapers. And so, and in Evansville, we have a Scripps Howard newspaper, and I write a column. I said, I'll do what I can. What I did was I got the head of the housing for the city to come to my office. And I told him, I said, I write a column. And I quote, he said, widely read column. And I said, directly, I want you to understand, if you move on this woman, Mrs. Story, and I described what she was like, I mean, this is the sort of thing you want to praise. If you move against her, I'm going to write a column about you. And he indicated that he would back off. But there came the year I went into the hospital myself, and I had significant surgery on my lung. While I was in there, they not only sent her the letter, they told her how much they were going to pay, and they gave her a date to get out. When I came out, several things happened in conjunction. I went to her and I said, I want to write the letter, and she said, no. She said, don't do it. She said, I don't want my business on Front Street. And I had to obey her. That was the first thing. She's going to get out. The second thing is that we had a visitor from Africa whose name was Fragambiza from Zimbabwe, theologian, but he'd come to preach, and he was helping me wrestle with a very, very important decision I had to make. The third thing is that there came a Sunday when he preached for us. And I sat in a tiny little chancel and he preached. And he, you know, these big, round tones he's talking to our church. And I don't know if it was planned or not, but when he was done, he sat down next to me and Mrs. Story got up and sang. She came front. She's leaning on two canes, one of those wrapped around here, like this. She came to the front and a cappella, she sang, nobody knows the trouble I see. Nobody knows my sorrow. Everyone in the congregation just quiet. Nobody knows the trouble I see. Glory, hallelujah. She sings slowly and lowly. Sometime I'm up, sometime I'm down. Sometime I'm almost too proud. And while she's singing, Fry, this African, sitting next to me, is just hunched down. And he's shaking his head like this, and he's saying under his breath, oh, Walter, Walter, he says, nobody should see that. But he means there was such great sorrow on him, he could scarcely stand the sorrow of the song that this woman was singing. Nobody knows the trouble I see. Nobody knows but Jesus. And then she went back down to her seat and sat, and very quietly we finished out the rest of the service. And parted. And later I went to her and I said, you know what Fray Gambisa said, Reverend Gambisa said about your singing? I want you to sing like that. She said, why not? Now, this is why I'm telling you this whole story. She said, why not? That's how they taught us to sing at Tuskegee. Now, go back to that. What was going on there with all the sorrows in her life and for all the reasons that she could put herself on Front Street by showing her sorrow and weeping in front of people and just groaning with what in her heart would have looked like self-pity, she didn't do. And she sure fooled me. She fooled Fry, she fooled the whole church. What she was doing was singing that, as she said, Negro spiritual, the way they taught, because she has this passion for rightness. She has this passion for craft. And that's one of the marvelous things about the artist. The artist doesn't always have to feel what you are going to feel. Artists are not always these spilling romantic people who wear their hearts bloody on their sleeves. They have a passion for doing it right. Do you get me? Please get me. And Mrs. Story was, for me, this marvelous monument to that sort of a thing. No, she wasn't spilling her guts. She was singing the way they taught. And for that very reason, spirituals can be preserved and we can understand them. not because people appropriate them for themselves. Let me repeat that. Not because people appropriate them for themselves, but because the way in which they were first presented becomes something universal as a gift unto all of the people. So let us put our heads down. Let us feel not hers, but our grief. That's what we were doing. Let us find a place to fetch up in that experience, which is composed, and find a language and a word for stuff that we felt but didn't know how to say before. Let us do that. But realize that somebody like her, that's what I meant when I said I float my boats out sometimes, and I'm not there. Follow me? Exquisite. Very important. So it's not just get the children to do whatever they want to do. You got children who want to be artists. It's not just say, oh, child, write whatever you want. Go outside the lines. I have to say, this whole concept, like in commercials where they say color outside the lines and all that, I understand a lot of people say, oh, that's good because this world is so restrictive. I'm sorry, this world is not terribly restrictive. It looks like that. I want to say, at some time, color outside the lines so you know exuberance, but if you're going to choose to be an artist, learn those lines. Then color outside the lines. And don't do it because you're sloppy or because you're just declaring self. Do it because you know what effect it has upon your readers, because you're composing this experience, not slopping it, and because the experience is detachable from you. You send it forth. Remember what I said, or what Annie Dillard says. Really, the artist is that flaming thing, that wick, which, when it is burning, no one cares about the wick, they care about what you can see. I think I'm saying a lot, and I also think I'm so grateful to you for listening. Let me say three things about craft and then do one more thing. Read you a piece. For me, there are three areas of craft that I work really hard at. And we can talk about them later if you wish. I'll just set this up. Finding. One, of course, is the stuff and the rules of the art that I've chosen, which are very complex. You know, paragraphing words, sounds, rhythms, language, images, figures of speech, whole large things, how a novel fits together, very complex. In fact, I have out here Psalm 1 about how this person loves the law of the Lord. And that law is something that this person meditates on day and night, huh? And it becomes actually their meat and their drink and their life. That's how I feel about the craft I'm in. I love it. I love thinking about sonnets. I may never write sonnets, but I love understanding what it is. It's like the organist who loves the organ. And if I want to bring writers after me, I want them to love the craft. I want them to love the language and never assume that because somehow or other they speak English, they can also write it well. I mean, we all think that, well, you know, I got it. Anyway, so just the way in which you love an organ, I love the craft. That's one. Number two, I also feel that it behooves me to know the past. T.S. Eliot writes this in a fairly old essay by now, which some people will accept and some reject, called Tradition and the Individual Talent. Eliot suggests that when you write, there needs to be at least some awareness of all the writing that has gone before. So when you write one new good thing and add it to this living organic mass of stuff, the whole mass shifts just a bit to accept yours. I like that. I write something and all of the literature shifts a bit. But in order for me to earn that right, I must read an awful lot of literature. If I had referred to Dun Cow, if I had had time to do that today, I would have told you how I drew upon Mort d'Arthur, for example, some marvelous, marvelous, exciting events in The Death of Arthur by Sir Thomas Malory that are in the Book of the Dun Cow. Catch me sometime, I'll tell you a story. So I need to know the past and read it. Up here I just finished rereading Metamorphoses by Ovid, and it fit pretty well what I was doing last week. Yeah, and that's not any great thing. That's just my job. I think that's my job. So art history, for example, as we were saying the other night, gets to be really, really important, both for those who teach and who are curators, but also artists, that they know something, even if they throw it all over, but they know what they're throwing over. Number three, it behooves me also to know people who are in my craft today. And so I've set up very close relationships. My editor of children's books is the best children's book editor I've ever had. His name is Bob Klausmeier. I have a continuing and writing relationship with Wendell Berry, who is a poet in Kentucky. Some of you may know Wendell Berry. We lived close enough together when I was in Evansville that we got to know each other and write back and forth. I do the same with playwrights. Madeline L'Engle is a friend with whom we have constant contact and back and forth. That's the third part of craft that I should never, I think for me, it's important not to be so terribly isolated, that I don't know how what I do looks to my compatriots and to others. Now, I would like to read you something. And let me set this up. This comes from Ms. Little and the Chronicles of Grace. It's the last full story in here, and I won't read the whole story, just a portion. I'm going to read here. It finally is going to be the description of a birth. I want to read this for several reasons to you, and I'm just going to ask you, don't think about it. Just live it while I read it. But how should I say? Number one, I will read this to you as an example of something where I think the craft worked. Much, and you don't have to know the craft. When it works, you're unaware of it. It just looks natural. But in this story, you will see the birth, Sherry, her name is Sherry Johnson. She's a preacher, is baptizing her daughter, her first daughter, her first child ever. And then the birth is here. And I would like you, as you read all the levels of understanding that come in at this moment, also think that this is for me a kind of an image of the flaming head. As Sherry gives birth, as God gives birth, so in a sense, when I wrote this, did I begin to understand I do, or the artist does as well. The setup. And by the way, I thank you for your patience in listening to me, and also for Mrs. Story, don't forget. The setup is this. All of Grace Lutheran Church is having its summer picnic. We're in a shelter. We're in a picnic shelter in the country. We're all black, but there are a few whites among us. Sherry is white. Her husband, John Breimeyer, is white. And she's the pastor with me in this church. Before I left, there were two of us. And we're having worship service. When the hymn was done, and the people focused forward, Pastor Sherry moved to the altar. And we proceeded, by the way, you will forget me in here. We proceeded through the familiar ritual, the worship that named and shaped us. Part of why I'm choosing this is the baptism. We prayed. She said, let the people say, and the people said, amen. We read three lessons from Holy Scripture, from Genesis and Romans and Matthew. Quietly, Sherry said, the gospel of the Lord, and the people turned a country shelter into holiness. They answered, praise to you, O Christ. And we sang again. I rose and preached. The people listened and laughed and frowned and blinked and listened. We gathered an offering. We sang. We know how to sing. And then, was Sherry's heart beat faster than usual? Pastor Sherry walked to the pedestal, its bowl and waiting water. Wraith-like her face, pale, it seemed to me, solemn below the cheekbones. In holy baptism, said Pastor Sherry Johnson, mother of the infant, our gracious Heavenly Father liberates us from sin and death by joining us to the death and resurrection of Jesus Christ. And so the rite of baptism began. John, her husband, was gazing steadfastly forward. Baby Hannah raised her wobbly head and rolled her eyes to the left and right. Maybe she was trying to find the source of her mother's voice. A host of people in the vicinity noticed the motion and turned smitten smiles upon the child. We are born, Sherry said, children of a fallen humanity, and so forth. She spoke softly, formally. One could hear the click of her saliva. Perhaps her tongue was dry and tacky on the roof of her mouth. At the appropriate moment, John stood. Hannah was presented, blinking over the people, as the one to receive the imminent baptism. Sherry acknowledged the presentation by a single nod. The two of them might have been strangers. Sherry prayed a long prayer regarding waters and let the people say, and the people said, amen. And then the child came forward, and the father, and the sponsors of the child, all of the sponsors, a munificence of sponsors, 13. They decimated the congregation, leaving gaps on the benches. John and Sherry, generally restrained in their behavior, had been prodigal in planning Hannah's baptism, bestowing on their daughter more godparents than Jesus had disciples. Young and old, male and female, black and white, sponsors surrounded the pedestal at the front of the altar and hid from view the baby and the bowl and Pastor Sherry. So I listened thereafter to what I could not see. I heard Sherry's voice arise from the tight wall of bodies. Do you believe in God the Father? Congregation responded, they speaking their faith, which would embrace Hannah hereafter. Do you believe in Jesus Christ, said Sherry? Do you believe in God the Holy Spirit? Yes, yes, they did. We did. There was a pause. I imagined someone shifting the weight of the babe, gingerly holding her head above the water. I imagine that Sherry dipped her own slender hand into the water, and I must have been right because she began the formula for baptism itself. Sherry said, Hannah, I. But she paused there. She stopped right there. All she had said was, Hannah, I, and she stopped. We waited for the next words. We all knew the next words, so it felt like leaning forward, you know, mid-stride. I baptize you. but she'd only said, "Hannah, I." A silence can last a while unquestioned, but only a little while. In the middle of a ritual, that's a very short while. But this silence continued, and I became aware of the fan in the back of the shelter, chattering foolishly, tappa, 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 tappa. What was the matter? I stared at the close knot of bodies around the stalled sacrament. None of them was moving. Sherry? I glanced toward the congregation, Herman Thomas. His experience slung low between his legs, smiled back at me and shrugged. He didn't know, tappa, tappa, tappa. I began to feel excessive urges of leadership, that I should do something. Walk over and cut through the crowd and learn the trouble and correct it. Do something. I grew very uncomfortable. All she had said was, "Hannah, I..." "Sherry, what's the matter?" Just then she spoke. I heard her voice rise up. The words were exactly the same, but her tone was different, stricken. "Hannah," Sherry said. She had to fight to pronounce the word. It came through a constricted throat, and when it did come, it was tiny as a wren, a piteous peeping. "Hannah," she squeaked, "I baptize you in the name." "Oh, Sherry." I understood. She was crying. Pastor Sherry had stopped to cry. Mother Sherry could not talk for a while because she was weeping over the baptism of her baby. All at once I saw her, as if there were no sponsors between us at all. I saw her, crimson-cheeked and moist, her hand below her baby, her hand still sunken in the water, but her face split open with its love above the child. Of course Sherry would be crying. She loved this infant whom she washed. It was hers, hers, the bursting in the blood of her own body, Sherry's. Of course she would weep at Hannah's second birth. Sherry knew birthing. She had birthed the baby the first time, and she was not ignorant of the meaning now. Again, I saw her as if nothing was between us, neither sponsors, nor space, nor time. I saw in detail that first birthing of the baby Hannah, for Sherry had entrusted me with that experience. I saw the bedroom. Sherry had delivered Hannah at home. She and John had been guided by the ministrations of a midwife. But the labor was long, and she told me that she suffered uncertainty how the baby ought to come. She didn't know what position she should take to accomplish this holy thing. How to get it right. How to get it right. For a long while, she leaned on John, and they walked up and down in the bedroom. The contractions made monuments of her belly, hard and hard and heavy, and she groaned. And then she kneeled at the side of the bed like a girl child in prayer, but the position didn't feel right. She climbed on the bed. She lay on her back, panting and gasping her breath to get this right. The baby was coming. She brought her knees up. Where did the pillows go? No, this wasn't right either. Too low. Not all of herself was in the thing. Restless, rearing, Sherry, laboring mother, trying hard in all things to be right and right for the sake of the baby, and the baby was coming. Suddenly, so she told me, and I saw it, suddenly she rose up on her knees on the bed, her knees apart to make a space for the life inside, sheets below to receive it, and she pushed down. She bowed down with all her might, and this is the way the baby was delivered. This was right. Milkweed splits its pod to send its seed adrift. Sherry burst her womb. Hannah slipped headfirst into the world. Hannah was born through the tearing pain of her mother in a rain of Sherry's blood, but the mother never considered the pain impossible nor the blood wrong. Blood, then. Blood had bathed this baby first, and now the water of baptism, which was a sort of sacred blood, washing Hannah whiter than snow. "Hannah, I..." Of course this mother would weep at the baptism of her child, her heart. She was weeping in gladness for her beloved, whom she loved not merely in sentiment, but in most holy doing, with her bones and her blood and her muscle, her womb and her suffering. She was weeping in knowledge, for this was a birth that no one could snatch away from Hannah, a life forever, and this time no one suffered pain but the Savior. No one bled but the Christ. But Sherry knew what sort of pain that was. Of course she would cry. "Me too. Herman Thomas too. Yolanda Jones. D.D. Lawrence. Pastor Sherry, I baptize you in the name of..." But again... Again, I saw Sherry as if there was nothing between us, neither time, nor space, nor flesh, nor worlds, and I recognized in that moment a most celestial thing, that I was baby Hannah, that Sherry was the figure of my God, and God was weeping. And this is what my heart sang. Holy God, how you have mothered me. For the crying voice of Reverend Sherry Johnson was precious, was the voice of the Holy One, Both Cole, daughter of the voice of God. Divine the words that she uttered at the second birthing. She was the authority of the love of God, effectual and effectually there. Oh, this was no metaphor, nor some image of my mind. This was sacred fact, present and immediate, and I saw how the weeping God had birthed me. I saw that restless God pacing and pacing the Empyrean, suffering the contractions of my bulking incompletion, my unborn presence, suffering in the deeps and the very elements of uncreated being. I saw God searching for and finally finding the holiest, most merciful posture for bringing me to birth. I saw the mighty God kneel down. God knelt in utter humility for a tender parturition, tender to me, hurtful to the tender parts of God. God sank into this world, humble to all the laws, bowed down to all of its pain. The Word became a flesh that could bleed a human blood. And having knelt, God groaned and bore me a second time, in pain. I was born in a rain of godly blood, blood that I had caused, for I burst my God, the brow and the palms and the heart of God, in order to be born. But blood my God did not begrudge me, for this was the very life of God upon me. Wash me, wash me, wash me clean. And even now the maternal God remembers my delivery. I am not lost in the multitude. What mother does not remember the single deliverance of every single child she bore? What mother doesn't whisper the baby's name, remembering? So God loves me and calls me by my name. At my own baptism, did my mother weep? Did the dear God weep when my human father, then my pastor, baptized me in Vanport, Oregon? And were the tears that washed me head and soul, perhaps, the tears of God? Is that the virtue of those waters? So much that has fallen between that time and this, the sickness of my youth, the rude cure of my congregation, the hyssop of grace, so much has been cause for weeping. Do you weep for me even now, my God? My God. Thank you. Tomorrow it'll be the whole business of the other.